Next up, we'll talk a little bit about the apocalypse, pyramids, Atlantis, and time. Matthew Petty back with us. He was with me back in 2013, and we're going to be talking with him about his works, Apocalypse Now, Alpha to Omega, Journey to the End of Time. And welcome back. Matthew Petty has a curiosity to explain an epiphany of 1977, which left him with only an illusory snapshot of something pretty real. His life has been relentlessly driven by that split-second moment of experience, something that happens to a lot of us, when a flood of information enveloped and transported him into the dimension of the Christ consciousness, a divine place, of course, of wisdom. And for more than three decades, Matthew's obsession, and he's got one, an obsession with the apocalypse, fueled early on by a sense of urgency, desperation, has uncovered remarkable stories, and we're going to talk with him a lot about these tonight on Coast to Coast. And Matthew, welcome back. It's been a while.
It sure has, George. How are you?
I'm fine. I hope you are too.
I certainly am. You know, it was great when I was at the contact in the desert, and I got to saw Graham Hancock, who asked me for a copy of my book, and Robert Bozzale, and I listened to their presentations. But I was very pleased with the panel that you hosted. It was a great panel.
Great people.
You knew how to ask the right questions. And, you know, George, I think what is important to talk about here is I think a lot of people are trying to figure out, you know, the biggest question, and all these ancient mysteries have stirred up a lot of curiosity. And these are some of the things that I've been thinking about for a long time. But one of the biggest things that we have going on is that most of our history, our most ancient history, is subliminally and consistently and repeatedly telling us that we have been seeded by a previous civilization that was destroyed in a flood with a few survivors of some kind, and they were in some kind of a vessel, and that they seeded the new race, which is us. Now, we have a lot of problems with that because we can't figure out, you know, how to assess this information, because there are so many things that we don't look at. But sometimes we fail to see some of the things that we need to associate in order to answer the question. And other times we just disregard things because we don't even think there's any kind of relationship at all to the answer of that question. And so what I've done is, for example, now let's just take, you know, you know of all the ancient texts that have emerged all over the world before any kind of dominating influence, before any kind of religion or influence of any kind, like I said. And there was just hundreds and thousands of these legends that we spoke about.
Yeah.
But one that made it to the biggest book of all in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, is still echoing that same core theme. But there are some key little components of that in the book of Genesis that tell us something that we're failing to see.
If you look at Genesis, Matthew, and take it literally, a lot of people probably couldn't understand it. But if you start thinking about it in terms of visitation and something a little more broader out there in the universe, extraterrestrial-wise, it starts to make a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does, but I don't believe that extraterrestrials are the answers for the questions. Now, I was at the contact in the desert, like I said, and I have, look, I definitely think that the information for the evidence that we have for UFOs is extremely overwhelming, and there is no doubt in my mind that it is pointing to something extremely phenomenal. And I've certainly thought about that as well and related it to a lot of things, and hopefully we'll be able to get to that tonight. In fact,
oh,
I know
sure.
We will.
Absolutely.
But the important thing about it is to make the foregone conclusion without thinking that they are from out there, that they are extraterrestrial, I think is a very short-sighted and maybe even a dangerous position to take. I think we need to start looking at human potential as the answers to some of these questions. And if we look at the very earliest part of the book of Genesis, which, you know, people say today you have your naysayers and you say, well, it's dogma. And it really, today's dogma is our misinterpretation of what was actually being conveyed and widely accepted at that time. And the reason for that is because there's a couple things that are in there that are very interesting. First, we have to try to figure out what the flood in the ark is. And the ark is a smoking gun. But they talk about 1,000 years of, the previous civilization lived for 1,000 years. This is before Noah. You know, all the people in that realm lived for 1,000 years. And then after the flood, Noah and his sons who survived lived for 1,000 years, while there was another culture of us living for less than 1,000, for 100 years or less.
Doesn't add up, does it?
Right. So we see, but nobody looks at it that way. People, you know, I was brought up Catholic, so I believed that, you know, well, there was a flood and there was a people, and you know, to me, it just all was the same generation, and the same thing was the concept in my mind. But when you look at the writing, it's clearly saying it. And I think that people forget that religion didn't begin as religion. It began as the first chronological accepted, widely accepted historical account that was based on many of all the earliest writings of mankind. But the biggest clue in Genesis that we fail to associate is the Tower of Babel incident. Now, the Tower of Babel incident, if we look at it carefully, it's telling us that mankind in this fossil record, so we have two fossil records, a source culture and our culture. And if we look at that, we say, well, we have our culture was able to do certain things. Well, how, and all of a sudden it was taken away, and they make it sound like it was just language.
Right.
But if we look carefully, we see that all of the ancient mysteries, which have really been the impetus to all of this, are found back before writing emerged, and there is no evidence of writing of any kind, and there is no evidence whatsoever of machines that apparently, it seems like machines had to be used, but there's no evidence of any kind of machinery anywhere. Yet we're seeing all these huge megaliths that have perfect holes hewn through them and edges and Tiwanaku not to mention, you know, all of them. So perhaps mankind really did have an extreme advanced ability that was given to them by these survivors of a previous society who had been very advanced. And we can demonstrate how that happened pretty easily by looking at a few things. First of all, the ancient texts. So the Tower of Babel indicates, this is important too, is that for some reason, it was taken away. But how did we get it to begin with? Like I said, the gods gave it to us. But it was so far removed, we weren't writing until after that. And if we look, and this is pretty interesting too, what Zechariah Sitchin was trying to, he and Graham Hancock have posited that the biblical flood was somewhere around 13,000 years ago.
Right.
And
where you and I were raised, as you just said, as Catholics, was about 5,000 years ago, they told us.
They did, and it didn't make sense to me because what we were thinking was, well, okay, so it was just our people, and it was just different people.
Yeah.
And that was the concept that we had. You know, it was just the same people as us, but they got destroyed, and then they got on a boat and survived. And so that concept has really dominated, you know, the human psyche for a long time. Now enter all the ancient mysteries that serve as the impetus to new discoveries and trying to figure out new answers for this cataclysmic flood and an advanced society. Now, where did the advanced society idea came in? It came in with the story of Atlantis, but the advanced society is really intimated in the book of Genesis with the 1,000 years, because man was living for 1,000 years before the flood, and then they showed two separate cultures after the flood, and the Table of Nations is no more than another king's list, just like the king's list of Manetho and Berossus and Herodotus and the like. That's what I discuss in my book, and I try to show it. And the reason why I'm doing this is because, and why I'm still persistent at it, is because we really need an infusion of new thought, a new perspective that helps us to answer some of the questions we still haven't been able to answer.
Matthew, let me interject Michael Cremo's thoughts for a second, and that is that he believes civilizations are hundreds of millions of years older than what most people
think. I know. Yes, he does. He comes up with some fantastic evidence that is just, you know, the bottom line, when we go to years and stuff like that, is when we get to talk a little bit, I won't get heavily into the metaphysics of truth tonight, but what we see is that time is just a measurable distance between thought and creation, okay? And and so, you know, when everything outside of nature has begun as an illusion in someone's mind, and the mental physical manipulation of our world is the processes that we do to create those things. And if we try to conceive of the idea that at one time mankind had the ability to do stuff through the mind, then we can explain these ancient mysteries without evidence of machinery and without evidence of writing. You know, how did they communicate? You can't build these monstrous and colossal, beautiful, perfect buildings without some sort of communication, and it doesn't look like there was any type of, you know, communication at all. I mean, you would think we would find something, and we don't.
You're right. And to build these things, you have to have architectural renderings, don't you?
Yes, of course. And you have to have, the concepts have to be shared with everyone in the project. And this is where, you know, this is where it's just, we have to consider all this stuff. So if we do consider it, and then we try to, you know, I link a lot of different things together that helps us to explain. Now, I'll tell you why I think, you know, historical archaeology is missing so many pieces, and this is where Michael Cremo's work comes in. You know, it's pretty dogmatic. Now, they do provide a lot of interesting evidence that clearly shows some things that pretty much say that 13,000-year flood couldn't have happened. I'm not saying that there wasn't a flood, but I can't consider that the one talked about in the biblical sense, because there are a few things. First of all, biblical flood was thought to be in all of the legends, not just in the Bible, but in the Enuma Elish and in the story, the Hindu story, and even in the story of Christian's story, he talks about
Zechariah,
the flood happening because he sees that Ra and Ta reigned for 9,000 years for Ta, and Ra only 1,000, and he thought it was cut short because of the flood. But it's funny, but he believed that Ta and Ra, both the god of earth, arrived from earlier times, from the planet of millions of years, in a celestial bark or ship called the Benben, which means the Pyramidian bird. And here's where we have two smoking guns. We have the smoking gun, which is Noah's Ark. We've been told Ark was a boat, but nowhere does it say it was a boat. And if we consider that the Tower of Babel was when man suddenly lost these magnificent abilities, and then nothing but confusion reigned, because now an ability to be, and I think the abilities were extreme telepathic and telekinetic abilities that were given to them. It was just nature to them. They didn't even know that they had them. They just did. And they were able to do all this stuff at the direction of these gods who were trying to progress civilization so that we would get to the point where, when it was taken away, we would start searching to try to find out what made all this happen.
What do you think, Matthew, of my thoughts that we were mankind, this civilization, a long time ago, that we already went to the moon way before we landed in 69? What do you think of that?
I don't know what you mean. You mean
we had technology? We had technology millions of years ago that got us to the moon already.
Well, I do believe that the previous society that existed was the supreme society. They made it possible for this, our society,
yes,
to survive.
Yes.
And I don't doubt at all that that supreme race that pre-existed this one could have done anything. They were the superhuman race, the Atlantis model. And you know, I may be getting a little ahead of myself, but there's some points that I think need to be addressed, and so we can say, how do we find this new thought model? I mean, we definitely see the 200,000 years of evidence of humankind, and we don't see any evidence of a major flood that destroyed anyone, but we don't see a source culture in the new models that Sitchin and Graham Hancock put out, because it appears that right during the same time we've had, you know, a flood, and not everyone was wiped out, and then suddenly, you know, we lost all this. So I think that the Tower of Babel incident gives us a better example, a better understanding of how this amazing technology that's evident about 12,000 years ago was suddenly lost, and why there was no evidence of communication, but also why we cannot interpret it well, because writing hadn't been introduced. Sitchin also talked, based on Manetho's story, that there was a 350-year chaotic period after divine and semi-divine reign, and that 350-year chaotic period may very well have been when the loss of that power came, and man was just frantic trying to... Nobody knew what anyone was thinking. Nobody knew. They could only speak in their regional languages, and they didn't know how to write, and it was just primitive communication, and they had to develop this. And the smarter tribes, like the Sumerians, were, you know, writing emerged in 3100, but all of this stuff took place thousands of years before that.
Before
and now
that,
all of a sudden, they're trying to explain it, and that's why the earliest and most consistent writings of humanity discuss a flood and a previous civilization. This is something that they knew for thousands of years, and it was echoed down through years and years of observation and family, and then suddenly it was gone, and they had to be able to try to tell the story, and we're the ones that never figured out what they were trying to say.
But you believe the flood occurred, but when do you think it occurred?
I believe that it occurred 4 to 7 million years ago. Now, here's the coup de grace on that. The coup de grace is that anywhere you look, we don't see what I read, and I still have the book from Columbia University, the Columbia History of the World version, 1972. And I always used to refer to that book because that book was very important to me. I would be able to look at certain things about history that I liked or wanted to know more about, and then I'd be able to read a lot of the basics about it, and then I could say, well, here, I want to know more about this, and I'd look at the resources and the footnotes, and I'd be able to find a lot more information.
All right, hold on, Matthew. We're going to take this break, but we're going to come right back, and we'll pick it up from there, that you believe the flood was 4 to 7 million years ago. Truly remarkable. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Matthew Petty. His works, a couple of them, of course, Apocalypse Now, which is a ebook series, 5 volumes, by the way, in Alpha to Omega, Journey to the End of Time. Matthew, let's get back to your thoughts of the flood being 4 to 7 million years ago. And what do you think caused it? An asteroid hit or something like that?
Well, you know, George, I don't think it really matters. This is what I hear. I'm going to read to you exactly what it says in Columbia History of the World.
Okay.
It says somewhere in late tertiary time, which is 4 to 7 million years ago, the relative positions of continents to the position of the Earth's poles shifted from sites in eastern Siberia in the southern and in the southern Indian Ocean to their present locations. With the South Pole relocated in the great mountainous Antarctic continent, a series of important events began. First, precipitation in the mountains turned to snow, then ice. Snowfields built up in the glaciers, and growing larger, the glaciers spread out over the lowlands. The freezing of Antarctica began about 3 or 4 million years ago and initiated a drop in the world's sea level because water would not return to the oceans by the normal melting in the summertime. Now, what we get from this is that this wasn't just a magnetic pole shift. This was a geographic pole shift, which could be extremely turbulent, and we have no idea what may have come along with this. But it's ironic that this story, you cannot find anywhere now. I mean, I know it was written in the 70s, but, you know, let's say, I don't say you can't find it, but I'll just say that it's a little more difficult to find. This was Columbia University's Columbia History of the World, Harper and Row, 1972. Now, the thing here is that they could tell the evidence in the strata, in the rock strata, when there's a different polar shift, they can tell by the magnetic fields that are created in the rock, and they could tell by certain things as to how and where these poles existed because of other evidence. I am not the scientist for this. I'm just reading what scientists that dealt with geological history have reported. And to me, that stays as concrete evidence that something happened. And, you know, George, we would have to go through. Our Earth's crust is 20 miles thick. And beneath the 7 miles, in the deepest oceans, it's 7 miles deep almost. And the crust is 12 miles thick. We'd have to sift through every inch to be completely certain. That's why I believe that when we think of things, we cannot presume, well, this is the truth, so therefore that's it. It's better to say, well, what if? And what if? That keeps us open and seeking for the truth that we're trying to figure out answers for.
Right.
And that's basically how I was able to come up with the story of Alpha to Omega, which is quite complex. Not complicated, but complex. It ties so many things together. I'm not going to get into that tonight, but in this particular instance, when we're talking about our history, we have to look at the things that have survived, and the oldest things that have survived are these people yelling to us that we were seeded by a previous civilization. And if we think that it was, we have to go with the fact that some of the science is still true. The historical archaeology, even though it's missing so many pieces, it does have evidence that we have human beings, Cro-Magnon men and Neanderthal men, going back as far as 200,000 years. And Neanderthal, they lived, you know, they were in Europe before Cro-Magnon got there.
Well, then they're saying now that Neanderthals roamed the planet along with modern Homo sapiens.
Well, they did. And they coexisted for nearly 100,000 years. And there was no struggle. In fact, the reports that, you know, the things that the evidence that they had exhumed, and believe me, it's always small, and then it's always embellished to further a philosophy, and I understand that, but we still see evidence, and we see that when they moved to these areas and there was no struggle, and then suddenly Neanderthal just disappears about 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, it doesn't make sense. And we also have nowhere in the current fossil record is there any proof or any kind of, in fact, there is no proof that a complete destruction of any of the of our human-like creatures of our current fossil record have happened. Now, we see a lot of bottlenecks where some things happen, like the caldera in Wyoming had happened. It created a huge bottleneck in the genome.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't wipe out humanity. So what we have to say is, okay, so how far back could this have gone? And when I was searching for these answers in the late 70s and the early 80s, I thought, well, you know, it had to happen a long time ago, and don't ask me how I had to figure that out, but I was trying to rectify all this stuff, and my mind is just that way. It just thinks that way.
Why do you use the Ark as kind of like a point of reference?
Well, the Ark is, for some reason you were getting a little low. I think I might have hit the volume there.
Okay.
The Ark represents, to me, it was spelled A-R-K, but to me the Ark represents an arc like a rainbow that bridged the gap between two points in time and two completely different civilizations. If that makes any sense to you.
So what you're saying, though, if I read you right, that the Ark wasn't what we think it was. It wasn't some kind of ship loaded,
right,
loaded with all kinds of animals, which I find pretty impossible.
No, and this is what I'm trying to say about the Tower of Babel, how important this is, because we understood, when I say we, those our ancients in our culture thousands of years ago understood this stuff. It was given to them to know. They had these abilities. It was given to them, and they didn't even know they had these abilities. They were just able to do it, and they were directed by the gods to further our civilization along because of what had happened prior. And that's something that I address in my book, and it's not important right now. So the Ark is our interpretation today. Like I said, first of all, the book of Genesis and the Old Testament of the Bible stands as the foundation to the three largest religions in the world. And similar exact tales. I mean, this is amazing. The Indian tale, the Indian branch of the Aryan family traced themselves back to Noah, but he was called Yerada. And he had three sons, Japheth, Charma, and Sharma. Is that Shem, Ham, Japheth? You know, it's kind of weird. And in ancient Greece, we have the Iapetos is one of the major gods in the Greek pantheon and Greek gods of lore, you know, the lore of all ancient gods. So these are tales that are telling us that there was a similarity, that there was gods. Well, now we have to answer, well, how did these gods get here? We have to come up, well, how did they get here? How could there have been a source culture if they were from 4 million years ago and or more? How could they have bridged that gap in time? And that's what I call an arc, an A-R-C, is a bridge. How could they have bridged that gap and made it here and then seeded our culture? Because all the ancient texts say the same thing. They continually and repetitively, nearly more than 90% of the thousand or more that exist, say the same thing, that a previous society reigned and that previous society seeded this race with the help of just a few survivors who survived from the previous race. Well, we look at that and go, that can't be possible. But we have to look at a few other things to show how that is possible. And that's why I believe that the two smoking guns that we're looking at, which is Noah's Ark, the human psyche is believing that the Ark was a boat. It never said boat, it said Ark, A-R-K. I see it as an A-R-C.
Mm-hmm.
And I see it as something from a supreme society that would have to be something so phenomenal. And it had to be almost like a god machine that could ameliorate the evolution of life on Earth, could suspend time so that a few people who were in whatever, how enclosed within it or around it or about it, would not age. And over all that time, the society would rejuvenate itself. And at a particular time when the stars and whatever aligned to this device, the gods could come out and start to begin their reign. And to me, the only thing on this earth that stands above anything we've ever seen or anything we have ever discovered is the Great Pyramid of Egypt. Not all of the pyramids, but the Great Pyramid. It is, the more we keep discovering things, the more about it, the more it becomes extremely difficult to say, well, what was it?
And you have got to assume, because I do, that it's much older than what they've told us.
I totally agree. Like I said, it was timeless. It was a machine created by a supreme race. Why is it that we have so easily been able to accept that a bunch of extraterrestrials with this high advanced technology came here and did things, and yet we can't see that potential in human nature at all, that a supreme society could have built a machine that could have ameliorated the evolutionary process and rejuvenated the life from the decay and destruction of their own, so that a race would form, and that at a specific time the ark would open and they would come out and they would be gods. Why do we think that the Egyptians had believed in earlier time that they could bury their pharaohs in a pyramid and they would live forever?
Yeah.
Where did they get that idea? Do you think that maybe it's because they understood in their most ancient times before they were writing that this stuff occurred? Now, I discuss a lot more in my work about how this, what this relates to as far as the Egyptians themselves. I am sure that if we were to dig deeper and deeper and deeper in Egypt itself, we would uncover much more remarkable things. And yet we have all these people now that are trying to destroy Egypt and stuff. I was just reading about it today.
Oh, I know. It's horrible. It's horrible. I'm convinced, as Edgar Cayce was, Matthew, that the Hall of Records is at the base of the Sphinx. Maybe Zahi Hawass and his group then dug under there and already found it. I don't know, but I think there's some ancient knowledge there too.
Well, you know what, George? I think that we have enough information now. We have enough information that we can start to look at our lives and our past and start to develop a different thought model for our history. But that's not easy to do. First of all, we would need an overwhelming disdain for the outdated model, because, and that would take education reform, more widespread awareness, which is extremely difficult because the stranglehold on human thought is controlled by these institutional pillars, which makes it extremely difficult to overcome.
Sure.
So only 10% of the, and that's the other thing, is only 10% of that are engaged in discovery, and they're trying to discover without a roadmap. So it's quite, and excuse me for being overzealous here, but it's just so important to me that, you know, I just can't help myself.
Why do you think, or what happened to the technology that we might have possessed a long, long time ago, though? Where did it go?
Well, that's the thing. What I believe is that this was part of the learning process. You know, we had these gods that gave us this ability, and we had the ability, and it took thousands of years to develop a savage race of evolved human beings to understand things that a supreme race knew. The question we really need to ask is, why would a few survivors from a supreme society take the time to create a new society and teach them something that we would have never learned? Why? Do you think that they were doing it to be gods and so they could be self-adorned? No, there was a much deeper meaning. And you know what, George? In all of the times that I've been doing all this search, one of the things that I found at the very end was called the metaphysics of truth. It is so sublime. It is so powerful. And yet, it was the last thing I discovered, and yet it turns out to be that it's the central core of reality itself. And it's just about taking that next step in a collective idea towards it. There's three principles. First of all, let me ask you something.
Go ahead.
Wisdom. What is wisdom? You know, wisdom, if I tell you this, wisdom is the uncanny ability to recognize truth without proof. What would you say? Does that ring? Does that resonate? Does it make sense?
Yeah, sure does.
It does. And another one is many hidden truths are often unobserved, not invisible. So these are some of the phrases I've coined, and yet they ring. They resonate to those who seek. But I'm going to give you a quick example of how this really works.
All right.
And this is the thought process that goes on all the time. Let's suppose you had to be in some major appointment tomorrow that would change your life forever, and you had to be there at a certain time, and you came home from work, and you said, wow, I got this appointment tomorrow, and your clock was up there. It was an hour slow, but you didn't know. It's the only clock you had in your house, and you set your clock accordingly to the time to get up, and you never made the appointment, and you missed out because you saw that the clock, you relied on the clock for the information, you didn't, and then you missed. So actions, belief, choice, or belief, choice, action. So on the other hand, let's say you get a hunch. Say you get a hunch. While you look at the clock, you say, that clock, I don't know, that doesn't right. And then you inspect it, and you inspect, and you find out that your hunch was right, and then you act upon that, and you save yourself the consequence of an improper action due to improper choice, improper belief. Now, there is another scenario where we might get a hunch, and they're going to forget it, that doesn't make sense, and we disregard it. We look the other way. And then later, we find out we were wrong, and saying, well, next time I get that hunch, I'm going to listen. Well, this is a thought process that goes on all the time. But the important part about that is that when we are searching for stuff, when we're trying to find answers to things, we get these hunches. And it's over time we get to use this practical wisdom, and we start being able to find truths, and we start being able to decipher them. And they emanate from all sources, so it's about saying, well, this all fits in. This fits in.
Hold on, Matthew. We're already at the top of the hour, but we'll be back.